Well, since you were so insistent, I've done without food or drink for 36 hours.
How do you feel?
Hungry and thirsty, of course.
Nothing else.
Ravenna, is this some kind of practical joke?
It's no joke. All our food and drink is treated with suppressants. Going without for a day and a half, they should be wearing off.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Sykes-Picot turns 100 this week, Britain's colonial redrawing of the borders that sowed the seeds of today's Middle East misery. Also, the virtually unreported death this week of one of America's most important lawyers, author Mark Lane. He began the process of opening up the corruption of the Warren Commission into the 1963 assassination of US President John F. Kennedy. After our 50-year commemoration of the Kennedy assassination back in 2013, we did on this programme, Mark Lane, a recording of him, explains how a team of CIA assassins were able to get round the Dallas police and simply vanish, as well as naming the names within the CIA that actually murdered the president. Also, a century this week since the Sykes-Picot Agreement was signed, this secret treaty between Britain and France divided up the old Ottoman Empire after the First World War. Many Arabs and Western scholars blame Sykes and Picot for drawing arbitrary borders across the Middle East. We also take a look at how Sykes-Picot was linked to the Balfour Declaration, which demanded a Jewish homeland in Palestine. Our sister show Dialects back at noon every Tuesday next week. We hear about the Spanish Civil War and Britain's Beat Generation poets in the 50s and early 60s from Bristol-based author Roger Yates. He's written a book called The Beautiful Season, The Story of the Spanish Revolution. Also, the second in a two-part interview about reporting the Brixton riots to London and interviewing reggae legend Peter Tosh with Britain's first regular black broadcaster Alex Pascal. But first, we're joined by Vince Howard. He's the new chair of Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Hi, Vince. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Tell us a bit about yourself. How have you come to take on this role? Have you been working in Avon and Somerset a long time?
Yeah, I joined in 1988. So I'm 28 years into the job. Started my service in Weston-super-Mare and worked in a variety of places. Ended up in training at headquarters, and that was where I joined the Police Federation about seven or eight years ago as a representative. Became the deputy chair or vice chair about 4 years ago. Was elected into that post, and as you know, Kevin stood down earlier this year. To stand as a PCC candidate, and that was when I took over the role.
Now, I think most of us think of the Police Federation as being separate, and so to what extent have you actually had on the ground frontline policing experience, and to what extent are you a sort of an officer sitting in an office doing effectively what is a kind of trade union style job for the police?
Yeah, my role now, having taken over from Kevin, is full time. We have four full time representatives. That represent officers from the rank of constable through sergeant, inspector, and up to chief inspector. But my operational policing background effectively ended in March of this year when I took over from Kevin. Up until that, I've been operational as well as working in training in the latter part of my time.
Now, you've been in the police for a long time.
Yep.
So what changes have you seen over the last, what is it, did you say 20 years?
28 years. The job has changed beyond any recognition, quite honestly. When you look at not just the equipment we had, but the crimes we dealt with. You look now at cybercrime and some of the cases that are having to be dealt with, certainly around sexual exploitation. There's no doubt it may possibly have been going on back in 1988 when I joined, but it was certainly something that wasn't dealt with. So yeah, the job has changed incredibly in that period of time.
Never mind the different types of crime that you seem to be dealing with nowadays, what about the actual amount of time that police officers are actually able to spend out and about, or whether you're desk bound? I mean, I know certainly in journalism things have changed a hell of a lot over the last 30 years, where you used to be able to go out and spend a bit of time on a story. Now a lot of the time journalists are having to work from literally from a kind of workstation, and they don't actually touch the story physically or any of the kind of individuals involved at all.
Yeah, it's we have got technology. Technology isn't great, I'll be brutally honest. I think there's an awful lot that could be done to keep police officers out on the streets, where the public want them. Sadly, we don't have that backup to be able to realise that at the moment. So it is difficult for them, definitely.
Give us an idea of the cuts there's been since the coalition government started in Avon and Somerset. How many police officers did we start with in PCSOs, and how many have we got now?
Okay, I mean, police officer-wise, if you go back around 5 years, we were somewhere around 3,510-ish, somewhere around that. We're now down to 2,800, just a whisper over. So we've lost 700 police officers, or around 20% of our establishment in that period of time. So it's significant, and certainly PCSOs have been cut as well. I genuinely don't know the numbers of those, but we certainly haven't recruited as many.
How has that actually affected the job, having 20% less of you there to do it?
Well, it's affected the job enormously, I think. I mean, now you've got a massive problem with officer burnout. You've got a huge problem with actually getting to jobs and dealing with jobs. And, of course, the problem you've got with that is that the police service is the public service, or the emergency service, that that never says no, or certainly rarely says no. And we seem to be picking up an awful lot of work from various other locations as well, and that's simply compounding the problem.
Well, some people would disagree with you when you say we never say no. They'll say, well, we phoned the police and they never came.
Yeah, and there are times when we simply run out of police officers. I mean that's a fact. I mean it's interesting, I was at conference this week, as you know, and not only Tom Windsor, who's the HMIC, but Andy Burnham, who's the...
Okay, HMIC, what's that?
Oh, sorry, yes. Yeah, so Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary. He's the chief inspector of all the constabularies. And Andy Burnham, the Shadow Home Secretary, was there as well. And they both said almost the same thing, is in there's a need to understand what the future demand is of the public service as a whole, not just the police, because what happens is that, as I said, the police end up picking up all sorts of jobs which really traditionally would not have been done by the police, and it's without a doubt.
Just give us an idea of some of the things you find yourself doing now that would have been done by somebody else, another public servant, before then.
Okay, the issue around mental health is significant. I know Sue Mount Stevens, who's our re-elected Police and Crime Commissioner, has made a declaration that people suffering from mental health won't be kept at police stations. But the reality is that if there's no emergency team to deal with it, there's no other place of safety for them to go. Or if the place of safety is full, what happens next? And the reality is that the teams available to deal with that are limited, and the police ultimately end up picking that up, because the individual, generally speaking, is in crisis, and that's when the police tend to have to step in and pick up the pieces.
Now, we touched on this briefly in the first hour, Vince. It is that there is definitely a perception out there that the police, there are people out there who are too rich and powerful, effectively too big to jail, that they have immense amount of power to pay for lawyers, etc., to defend them, and there are, for example, things like financial crime, money laundering, drug dealing. I mean, we've seen this horrendous thing over I think it was about 2-3 months ago, with a whole load of street level drug dealers being arrested and jailed in Bristol, many of them homeless, which isn't really very productive. And many people see that the police are going for soft targets, whether it revolves around VI paedophiles, very rich and powerful people who are involved in child abuse, financial criminals, money launderers, even things like false accounting and fraud, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Is it complicated crimes? So the police are starting to be perceived by many people as only going for the easy crimes, and that some of the more rich and powerful people are getting away with it.
As an organisation, we would clearly look to try and deal with crime at all levels, and it's right and proper that it is dealt with at all levels. So your street level dealers might be picked up by possibly your neighbourhood policing teams. And your serious organised crime is going to be looked at by the serious organised crime groups and our regional crime departments that would look at such matters. And I can assure you those departments do exist and they are looking at crime at all levels. I couldn't comment on whether or not we actively avoid anything. I would be very surprised if that was the case.
Because a lot of people they have not only wealth but power, and also the police need to consider, don't they, if there's any prospect of a prosecution. And when people have got a lot of money and they can afford to pay the best lawyers, yes, it may not be the best people to prosecute from the police's point of view. Might not be time well spent.
Yeah. I think the Crown Prosecution Service will look to get a conviction. There's no doubt about that. And if they don't feel that they can get one, irrespective of who the person is or how much money they're prepared to throw at their defence, ultimately the Crown Prosecution Service will endeavour to prosecute, but they must have a reasonable chance of conviction.
Now, give us an idea of what you've had from... you had a bit of a pep talk, I understand, from Theresa May this week, the Home Secretary. What do you make of her?
The Home Secretary was... very similar to the way she's been in previous years. Although what I would say is that we've clashed swords with her in the past, and that doesn't work because ultimately we've still got to work with the Home Office and particularly Theresa May.
Does that mean you just have to do as you're told?
No, not at all. I mean, Steve White and Andy Fittis, who are our national chair and national general secretary, spend a lot of time working with the Home Office, and I think it's important to remember that as a staff association, we are here to influence and represent and negotiate. That's what we do, and I think that the conference as a whole, when you look at the people who were there at the conference that were actually speaking, which included obviously Theresa May, Andy Burnham, Tom Windsor, as I said earlier on, we also had Alex Marshall there from the College of Policing. And the Chief Constable Sarah Thornton, who's the chair of the National Police Chiefs Council. So there's some real interest in policing. No, it's not a case of doing as we're told. It's been a while since Theresa May has come in and given us a pat on the back, it would be fair to say. And there were some things in what she said which were unhelpful, being leapt on by the press, particularly around finances, which does us no favours. I've got to be honest and say that. But no, it's not a case of doing
this. This is about the Police Federation spending money on holiday homes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What's been seized upon is a multi-million-pound property portfolio, holiday homes, secret accounts, slush funds. And the reality is nothing like that at all. Yes, there is a property portfolio if you collectively look at the Police Federation as a whole. You know, the Avon and Somerset Joint Branch Board owns its own building. That is part of the property portfolio.
What about holiday homes as well, though? Why does the Police Federation need holiday homes?
Okay, the holiday homes, let me give you an example. Our income in Avon and Somerset comes effectively from two sources. One is from the members through subscriptions, and the other one is through member services, because we offer a really, really comprehensive insurance policy as well, which our members pay for, and that's where our income is derived from. We invest our money in a variety of locations. I can assure you they're not holiday homes, because we don't have that kind of money. Other boards have chosen to invest their money in property as well as in stocks and shares and various other places. But there are no secret accounts. Accounts are published, they're audited, and they're under the scrutiny of trustees as well. And certainly where we are, we have a very open and transparent transparent policy in relation to our finances.
What about Hillsborough, which came up as well this week? Because that's really, I suppose, an indictment of the police being without having any proper oversight into what they're doing. That is South Yorkshire. There's also the brewing is another problem up there with the Orgreave, the breaking of the miners' strike, where it does appear, certainly in Hillsborough and in Orgreave, that police have used their power to simply break the law and also to then go for a massive kind of cover-up. I mean, don't you think that this also diminishes public sympathy for the police? When you're talking about, oh, we don't want any more cuts, people think, well, you know, we don't really support this kind of organisation that we have to pay for and yet gets away with all sorts of crimes itself. You know, that is to say a conspiracy at Hillsborough to literally pervert the course of justice, changing evidence, changing statements, putting pressure on police officers not to tell the truth, for example.
Yep. So I'm just trying to scribble all that down. There's a lot of points.
I just wonder what lessons that you think we can learn from Hillsborough. Mainly, this is about public perception of the police, isn't it? How can you have public confidence when you've got things like that going on?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let me firstly start by saying, you know, Hillsborough was a tragedy and should never be forgotten. 96 people died tragically on that day. Our mistakes were made. What I would say, if we look at the policing operation, I've been involved in public order policing for the vast majority of my service. And the policing of public order events and public safety events, particularly around football, have changed. You know, you talked about changes right at the beginning, and that has changed beyond any recognition. And to go to a sporting event now is a much, much safer event to go to.
But the problem with Hillsborough wasn't so much what happened on the day. It was more the institutional cover-up afterwards, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And clearly there's an ongoing inquiry in relation to that, and if people have been found, you know, if police officers have been found to be anything other than truthful, then they clearly need to face the consequences of that. Honesty and integrity are at the heart of the police service. It's what the public expect, and I can tell you now, virtually every police officer I've ever worked with will tell you exactly the same thing, that it sits at the top of the tree of the most important things, because it builds trust and confidence with the public. In terms of Orgreave and the use of the police, I mean, we're going back a very long time. I believe Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister at the time. And were the police used inappropriately? Well, I think Andy Burnham was calling for a public inquiry at the Federation Conference into what occurred at Orgreave. And there's no doubt that that'll be very interesting when it comes out to see what part the government played, and indeed what part the police played in supporting the government's actions.
Okay, I mean, all very well with intentions, but how can we make sure that the police are being honest with us in these sorts of situations? I think there's another problem here, I suppose, in the background, which is the IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission. And many people see it, well, it's it's professionals investigating the police. It's not really proper accountability.
I mean, there are a number of problems with the IPCC, I think, but I think there's a wider issue here in relation to the blame culture that exists within the police. And I think that's where potentially some of what has occurred in the past could well have come from. There's almost a presumption of guilt before any inquiry or any investigation. You know, the IPCC treat officers quite badly post-incident. The duration of their investigations are horrendous sometimes. It's right and proper that if a mistake is made, police officers need to put their hands up to that mistake, and we need to learn from it and not vilify police officers if they've done something wrong.
What about the firearms officers? This is another story this week that the Police Federation is warning nationally that there's a shortage of firearms officers, and it was even, I don't know if this what you make of the claim that the army might have to come out on the streets, but police officers seem reluctant to take this firearms training, and what do you think is behind that?
Yeah, and again, that comes back to what I've just said there around the blame culture. You know, if a police officer ends up taking that massive decision to discharge a firearm and take somebody's life, if that's what occurs, it's a split second decision. They certainly wouldn't be taking that decision lightly. They would clearly be considering the proportionality and the legitimacy of their actions and the necessity. But unfortunately, this blame culture is a massive issue. With regards to armed officers and the numbers, I think 1,500 is what the Home Office are talking about introducing. But when you consider what happened in Paris and how many police officers and, I believe, the military too were deployed on the streets, you're talking thousands, and we simply do not have the resources now to get anywhere near that kind of resource.
I mean, are police officers happy about being armed? Do they just not want to be, or what?
I think the traditional view of policing by consent still exists. Policing is still routinely unarmed. It is still done primarily by consent, and most police officers want to be safe. They want to be able to go to work, do their job to the best of their ability, serve the public. It's a true vocation to the vast majority of them. Do they want to be armed? It's difficult to speak for them. I would suggest that they probably don't. They understand there is a necessity. There is a necessity for things like taser, CS incapacitant, handcuffs, body armour. But to routinely arm police officers, I don't think it'd be the way forward. I don't think that would instill any further trust and confidence in the police. However, we have to be cognizant of what the terrorist threat is to the UK. We're currently on a significantly high alert, and although we don't know what happened yesterday with the flight from Egypt, it just goes to show it's a very real threat that is very close to our doorstep.
But something like that, I mean, it's, how are armed police officers going to help in a situation like that, which looks possibly to be some kind of bomb attack?
Again, it's security airports or any ports for that matter are essential, and clearly you need armed officers for that. But you know, from a terrorism perspective, the erosion, one of the issues we have is the erosion of neighbourhood policing. We're losing neighbourhood cops. Anybody who lives in the communities in Bristol will see they don't see their cops quite as often as maybe they did before. They don't come to quite as many meetings as maybe they did before. Or attend the village fete or whatever it happens to be. And the truth of the matter is that information and intelligence, which is at the heart of what we do in policing, is being reduced, and it's being reduced because of the cuts to policing.
Kevin, you wanted to come in.
Just one very quick one. Yeah. The next catastrophe has already been spelled out. Shoot through. A really serious terrorist incident in London,
yeah,
in which if the Met armed squad shot their way through will produce terrible civilian casualties. There's a real...
Can you just explain what you mean by that, Kevin?
Yeah. A policy called shoot through has been passed for the Met in London. It's been sanctioned. This means that you ignore the civilian casualties. You shoot as many bullets as you think you need to get the terrorist, even if half the casualties are civilians. It's terribly dangerous, and it is the next Hillsborough.
Well,
nobody will be able to explain one dead terrorist and 15 dead civilians in London. But a lot of what you've said, sorry, don't get me wrong, I'm raising that because I think it is where the disaster is coming. But a lot of what you said, the lack of ordinary police officers on the street, you lose intelligence, totally, you know.
Yeah.
And most ordinary policemen and women, as you know, are really good people.
Absolutely.
But catastrophes like Hillsborough,
yeah,
are bad news, but shoot through is the next bad news.
So anyway, Vincent, I wonder if you know anything about this policy. It does sound a little bit dangerous, the idea that the police would be saying, well, it's okay if you can actually fire at someone if there may be civilians in the distance that might actually catch some of these bullets. It sounds like a horrendous policy.
It's certainly not a policy that I'm aware of. And as I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, the officer discharging the firearm, whether they discharge one bullet or 47 bullets, has got to account for every bullet they fire. The IP IPCC would expect that. And, you know, they still got to be proportionate in what they do, have a legitimate backing to it. It must be necessary, and ultimately they are accountable for what they do, irrespective of the government policy.
I mean, we've seen quite a lot of drift in many other forms of public policy towards a kind of US-style policing approach. I wonder what you make of that, because certainly there seems to be in the US quite a lot of people dying, you know, whether it's police or gunmen on the streets, because of the prevalence of guns. And, you know, I wonder whether you think that maybe Britain is heading in a similar direction. I mean, just it's fascinating to read from The Guardian today this report that's just out from the prisons, saying that guns are now available in some prisons to prisoners because of the problems with the prisons, and drugs are getting in, guns are getting in, that sort of thing.
I still firmly believe we're still very lucky in this country. We don't have a gun culture. There is the availability of guns. There's absolutely no doubt about that. You know, we've had shootings in Bristol in the past. We will undoubtedly have them in the future, I suspect. You know, the teams that work in Bristol do their best to try and prevent that from happening. I think we're a long, long way away from the United States. On Monday evening, I spent some time with Lord Gordon Wasserman, who is a Tory peer and a Lord, and he spent some time in Philadelphia in New York, and did some work around police and crime commissioners in the UK, and he will tell you that the policing couldn't be any more different between America and the UK. Their violent crime, their crime related to firearms, way exceeds anything that we have in the UK, thankfully.
Martin, I'm going to bring you in here, because one of the things I'm often thinking of is high-level crime. That is to say, things like, you know, it really depresses me to see street-level drug dealers sent to jail, because what that does is effectively it's just a recruiting tool for more street-level drug dealers, unemployed people, young people, for example, to then take up those positions. And where we're really dealing with here, or maybe what we're not dealing with, is the high-level drug dealers.
Well, I mean, I think there are police officers, senior police officers and others all over the world who are aware that the laws about drugs are not entirely rational. We can go out and get as drunk as we like, and we can smoke ourselves to death, you can advertise it on television, etc. And I think there's a growing awareness about this, and a lot of retired police officers have spoken about it. I think when you've got there was a report came out in 2009 by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, which is mostly staffed by police officers, and it said that during the financial crisis in 2008 there was a giant sucking sound as all of the dirty money all over the planet was sucked into the banking system to preserve it. That's the level at which this functions. And you could argue that the banking system was only saved by the intervention of the taxpayer and the drug cartels. Meanwhile, a 16-year-old can be arrested for a small amount of cannabis and have their career ruined, future employers informed and so forth. But I don't want to make a particular case for that. What I'm more interested in is the independence of the police from the intelligence services, because I'm afraid the evidence is that NATO intelligence services, going back decades, have actually had a hand in terrorist incidents. And in Italy they're very strongly aware of this, because the Italian civilian police force has uncovered, the head of the Italian Supreme Court Imposimato has written a book about it, that most of the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, the bombing of Bologna railway station, the kidnap of the prime minister, was carried out by terrorist groups which had actually been basically created by the intelligence services. And I think what we've seen in Northern Ireland with the reform of the Royal Ulster Constabulary and the creation of the Peace Service of Northern Ireland is the idea of trying to create a sense that the police are genuinely independent of the government of the day, and also, if necessary, critical of the intelligence services, rather than just being a low level. You know, basically, we leave all that high level stuff to them, and we just deal with the low level stuff. I would like to see that the police were independent, and I think they are. And I'd like to, I think, you know, I've had dealings with the police over the last 30 years when you've been a police officer, and they have changed enormously. It's become a much more professional outfit than it was when I used to live in Brixton in the early
1980s. I'll try and paraphrase what Martin's saying here, is are you able to deal with, you know, basically people who have got into the criminal justice system one way or another, and actually investigate them properly? Because what Martin's saying, and I think there's quite a lot of people out there, I would certainly agree that we've got problems within our own system. It's very easy to point the finger at terrorists from abroad and people who are trying to do things from other parts of the country, but what about the criminals within our own country, you know, often within these powerful positions? I suppose I'm going back to the point we were making earlier on, Vince.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say, what can I say? Other than what I said before, you know, my view is maybe naively, nobody is above the law. I'm sure politics comes into play. I'm sure money comes into play. I'm sure there are many, many other factors. My view is that police officers will deal with things as they see them. I'll go back to the honesty and integrity element of it. And that doesn't matter whether you're dealing with somebody for a £3 million fraud or somebody who has stolen £100 worth of property from somebody's shed. You know, the reality is nobody should be above the law. Are people above the law? Possibly. I don't know. But they shouldn't be. And the police, as far as I'm aware, deal with individuals as they see them.
Well, I know when we were talking to the prospective police and crime commissioners a few weeks ago, before Sue was Mount Stevens was re-elected, she was saying that actually that she was aware that evidence had been passed to the police locally about the sale of Bristol Port, because it looked as if that might have been public land that was handed to friends of the mayor for less than it was actually really worth. But anyway, Kevin, you wanted to...
The police, you know, have to enforce the law. It's on the drug stuff. The big denial situation is in Parliament. Most MPs are in denial about what the drug problem actually is, and the police wind up with it in their faces. You know, it's Parliament, it's statute and things like that need to change.
Well, what is the real drug problem then, Kevin?
Yeah.
What do you mean? What is the real problem?
Sorry?
What is the real problem with drugs?
Oh, you know, there's a kind of flavour of the month that all drugs are wrong. And as Martin pointed out, what about alcohol, cigarettes, etc.? There's an issue that MPs, there are two issues, and you raised one of them, and it was raised in the Queen's speech, a second chance. We can't afford as many people as are winding up in prison with no chance of getting a job when they get out. In the old days, it didn't matter. There were loads of labouring jobs. You know, people could always find something. They can't anymore with all the record keeping and everything. And there's a serious danger that people we're dumping in jail for small drugs offences will never be able to get a job.
Yeah.
But the problem, I think, lies less with the police than members of Parliament who just don't get it.
Vince, do you think there are people out there, police officers out there, that can see a case for decriminalising drugs? Because I can remember, I've talked about this several times on this show. There's a Humphrey Bogart film called Key Largo, where he's involved in dealing with the mafia in the United States in the days of Prohibition. And one of the things that shocked me about that film, and I did laugh out loud when I saw it, was how much the mafia were desperate to keep Prohibition, how much they wanted to keep it. And I wonder what you make of that idea that actually organised crime loves the prohibition of drugs.
This is down to the policy makers and the decision makers. In all honesty, one of the points I did want to make today that was raised at conference was about the requirement for some kind of public debate around the police and what the police actually do, because I don't think it's for me to sit here and say I don't mind if you smoke a bit of cannabis, but I do mind if you take cocaine. Because that's a personal view. My personal view clearly as a police officer is that drugs at this moment are illegal, and whether I agree with them or not, you can't possess them, you can't sell them, you can't take them. This is where we need to go back to that requirement for a public debate, and the public need to understand there are fewer cops, they're trying to do more with less, faster than they did it yesterday, under greater scrutiny, and ultimately there needs to be a decision. Do you pay more and have more cops, or do the police do less? That's what it boils down to. And the government, ultimately, they're in power because of votes. That's what it comes down to. And that's what they're interested in. They're interested in votes and power. Because ultimately, if the public aren't interested in the police and the public aren't interested in drug dealing, it doesn't get to Whitehall and it doesn't get dealt with. There's a nice conspiracy theory for you.
Fascinating. And of course, we've got this ongoing investigation in several areas. I'm not sure if Avon and Somerset's involved into potential fraud by mainly by the Conservative Party. Also, last week, Michael Crick on Channel 4 News was talking about possible Labour Party election expenses fraud. Because, of course, then you were talking about we've elected these people, but what if they've overspent? I mean, what are your thoughts about the police's role there? And how, I mean, what's happened, I believe, as I understand it, is individuals have simply taken what they've seen as receipts from hotels and things like that to police officers around the country, and they've said, right, we're going to investigate this now. Is that actually how it works? You just walk into a police station with evidence that you think is important about something like that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, that's how the recording of a crime quite often happens. Somebody will gather some evidence, or they will bring to the table some information for you, and an inquiry will be set up. It's as simple as that. And I think what's really important is it doesn't matter whether you're a member of parliament or indeed a police officer or even any member of the public. The law exists, it exists for a reason, and it's right and proper that it's investigated and investigated properly with impartiality.
Well, we had the Chief Crown Prosecutor on this programme for the South West a few months ago, and he certainly didn't pull any punches. So I think if you've got any evidence of crime, doesn't matter how powerful or rich these people are, just take it into your local police station. Anyway, Vince Howard, new Chair of Avon and Somerset Police Federation, thanks very much for joining us today. Bit of a grilling you got there on the Politics Show.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Well, it's 100 years since the Sykes-Picot Agreement. This is the agreement between France and Britain at the end of the Second World War, which drew and redrew the boundaries of the countries right across the Middle East. It was also, Martin, wasn't it, part of the end of the Ottoman Empire?
Well, yes, and it's seen as the root of many of the conflicts which have subsequently been endured in that region of the world.
It was May the 16th, 1916. It was secretly signed, but actually it was leaked afterwards. The content of the deal was effectively the establishment of five entities, they call them, actually countries, in the Levant. The first entity extended from Baghdad to the south to include Kuwait, reaching to the Gulf Coast. That was under direct control of the British. The second was what's now northern Iraq, Jordan, and the Negev Desert, reaching down to the Sinai. This was part of also under British influence, but there was a little bit more autonomy there. Then there was another country, effectively. It was they say entity, but it's sometimes several countries, including a coastal area from southern Lebanon to the north towards the provinces of Mersin, Iskenderun and Adana. That is up in Asia Minor, which is Turkey, effectively. It extended to the inside of Anatolia too. That was all under direct French control. And then finally, the Syrian desert. This was under French influence. Martin, the redrawing of the boundaries by these big colonial powers back then, a lot of people, particularly looking at the coverage of this from the Arab world, they were saying quite often that these weren't the natural boundaries at all, that there were peoples who were virtually severed, cut in half by these redrawing of boundaries by Sykes-Picot.
Well, I think what's interesting is that they didn't use always the existing administrative divisions of the Ottoman Empire. And, of course, the Ottoman Empire was also an imposition on the peoples of the region, so that wouldn't necessarily have been a good idea anyway. But I think it's quite significant, for example, that the British got northern Iraq, including Mosul, because they were already thinking in terms of getting hold of the oil that was up there. And therefore, they would cut off, you then end up with artificial countries like Syria, for example, which has got a very, very varied population and very bizarre sort of straight line boundaries. The problem with trying to undo all of that is the same as in Africa and elsewhere, is that unravelling it is potentially just as dangerous as leaving it as it is.
Well, so, looking at Syria particularly, which was originally under French control and influence, how did that then become, how come the Syrians then sort of became friendly with the Russians and allowed Russian ships to dock at the Eastern Mediterranean?
Syria was originally, I think it was part of the Hashemite monarchy, I can't remember, perhaps you can remember, Kevin, who actually ran it. French ran it, didn't they? And they put in their own stooges, and then eventually they were kicked out. I mean, the sort of old guard in the Arab world were kicked out in the 50s, 60s. There were several coups in Syria, and eventually, sort of, you know, radical progressive nationalist officers from the Ba'ath Party became the rulers of Syria, as in Egypt and Iraq. And of course, they weren't necessarily democrats, but they were not entirely under the control of the British and the French. And, you know, there's been continuous contest ever since. I mean, if they could get rid of Assad, and I don't think they can, they will have finally got rid of that kind of tradition in Arab politics.
Well, most people don't realise that Sykes-Picot was secret for a while until the Russian Tsar was deposed in a popular revolution in 1917. The Bolshevik communists, led by Vladimir Lenin, found a copy of the Sykes-Picot agreement in the government's archives. Lenin's colleague Leon Trotsky published a copy of the agreement in his Vestia, the newspaper, on November the 24th, 1917, a year or so after it was drawn up, in an attempt to expose the great power's plans to inherit the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War. Lenin called the treaty the agreement of the colonial thieves, and the exposure of it called a political scandal for Britain and France. So in 1917, Christmas time, this was all over the newspapers over here. This is terrible. What are they doing?
Well, indeed, and people may remember that Lawrence of Arabia supposedly had promised his Arab rebels that they were going to get their own state if they rebelled against the Ottomans, and then, of course, behind his back they were being stitched up. I think that's a rather romantic view. I think they always intended to stitch them up, and Lawrence was probably aware that they intended to stitch them up. I'm afraid empires haven't gone away. We're still struggling with the same kind of attempts to dominate geographical space which dominated the 19th and the 20th centuries. Well, and people are still dying over it.
Well, then we come on to the Balfour Declaration. Britain, during its negotiations with Sharif of Mecca, Hussein bin Ali, took up the responsibility of establishing a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. This came in a letter written on the 2nd of November 1917 by then British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour to Baron Walter Rothschild, a close friend of the Zionist movement leader Chaim Weizmann. The British commitment was endorsed in 1920 as Herbert Samuel, a British Jewish Zionist, arrived in Palestine as Britain's first High Commissioner in the country. In that year, the British Mandate of Palestine was formalised by the League of Nations in a special article. Following the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and Britain's capture of Palestine and Iraq, Britain gave up the idea of partitioning the Ottoman Empire's properties, which the Sykes-Picot Agreement had laid out. Instead, it focused on the mandate system approved in the San Reno Conference, which was held in France in April the 26th, 1920. Prominent Lebanese historian Kamal Salibi believed the main considerations taken at the time were related to oil and transportation tracks, that is, rail and that sort of thing, and roads. The British faced many difficulties during the war, and they tried to occupy Iraq. The outbreak of the war had proved strategic significance of oil. At that time, Britain was controlling oil resources in Iran too. Its main concern was to prevent the Germans, key contributors to the Turkish Petroleum Company, from reaching oil fields that were known to exist in Iraq's Kirkuk region. So a lot of this was about oil, wasn't it, and about energy. It's still today exactly the same.
It is, and of course the Kurds were not given a state as part of this settlement, because that would have, A, there would have been a, you know, an independent state, and they're not really interested in that, and B, because Britain wanted the oil in Mosul, as I said to you before. These considerations are still at work behind the war in Syria, for example. Underlying that is a desire by the ruling elite in Qatar and Saudi Arabia to supply Europe via Syria with their oil and gas as a way of cutting the Russians out of the European market. And of course the alternative plan, the so-called Islamic pipeline, is to run oil and gas pipelines from Iran through Syria so that they can actually access the European market. And that's why all these people have been dying, so that we can have a pipeline. Although in actual fact, I don't think anybody's going to get a pipeline.
BCFM. Well, now on to go and have a look at the death of Mark Lane. Martin, we did a programme back in 2013 about the death of the assassination of President Kennedy, which really pointed the finger at Lyndon Johnson, the CIA and the FBI as being behind it, and looked into the reasons. You can find that online. But tonight I thought we'd re-have a listen to again the testimony of James Files, who was, it seems, certainly a lot of evidence points towards him simply being the grassy Noel assassin. So let's have a listen to his testimony now.
When they started proceeding down Elm Street, shots started being fired from behind, and I assumed that it was Mr. Nicoletti because he was the one who was in the building, and I knew that Johnny Roselli was there. I remember the shots ringing out, and even though the president was being hit with the rounds, I was considering it a miss because I knew that we were going for a headshot on the president. And I had known he had been hit in the body, but I didn't know what part at that time. When I seen the body lurch and I saw the body lurch again, I heard another shot that missed, and we were supposed to hit no one but Mr. Kennedy. And I guess Governor Cumley got hit with one of the rounds at that point. And I wasn't even sure there because I was keeping Kennedy as best I could in the scope on the fireball. And when I got to the point where I thought it would be the last fill of fire, I had zeroed in to the left side of the head there that I had, because if I waited any longer, then Jacqueline Kennedy would have been in the line of fire, and I had been instructed for nothing to happen to her. At that moment, I figured this is my last chance for a shot, and he still had not been hit in the head. So as I fired that round, Mr. Nicoletti and I had fired approximately at the same time as the hit started forward, then it went backward. I would have to say that his shell struck approximately 1/1000th of a second ahead of mine, maybe. That's what started pushing the head forward, which caused me to miss in the left eye, and I came in on the left side of the temple.
Well, that actually was just a sound effect at the end there, but certainly the Kennedy assassination does seem as if that James Files was the guy that actually finally fired that shot. And there's a lot of evidence for that too. And one of the first people in the world that really started the true investigation into the cover-up and to find out what really happened was Mark Lane. Let's have a listen to him now being interviewed about his latest book, which is called Last Word.
There was a group within the CIA, a top-secret organization, not even known to many people in the CIA. It was run by a man named Sidney Gottlieb. All of this is confirmed. Part of it is the Church Committee, United States Senate investigation. Other work has been done, and he's admitted all these things are true. Gottlieb ran an organization within the CIA which planned assassinations of heads of state, not in the United States, but outside of the United States at that point. He smuggled various weapons into various countries to kill heads of state. He did that personally. It's all absolutely documented. He was such a remarkably brutal person that during the war in Vietnam, he went, at the request of his little group in the CIA, he went to Vietnam and found Vietnamese prisoners of war, that is, Vietnamese who had been captured by the Americans.
Right.
And had arranged to have the top of their skulls removed.
Oh, my God.
Electrodes put into their brains. It sounds incredible, but it's absolutely true. It's all, it was called part of the MK Ultra program of the CIA. It's all
he sounds like he's worse than Joseph Mengele, one of the Nazis.
And then put electrodes into their brains and put a group of them together and put knives there to see if he could control them to kill each other. Of course, it never worked. So they murdered them all and then burned their bodies. Now, this is Sidney Gottlieb's special group within the CIA. Do you know who provided all of the credentials for the Secret Service in Dealey Plaza in Dallas for Kennedy's visit there for November 22nd and 23rd? That same group.
That group, yeah.
That group provided all the credentials. How important was that? After the shots were fired, a Dallas police officer, Joe Marshall Smith, he testified before the Warren Commission, was told that he wasn't on duty. He was just there watching. All the Dallas police were told they had no assignment that day. Dallas Sheriff's Department were told they had no assignments that day. The only Dallas police officers who were working were just controlling traffic in various areas, but nobody was there protecting the president. Anyway, he was there, and he ran up to the wooden fence. He drew his gun. He was certain that the person who killed the president was behind that wooden fence, and he saw a man coming out. He pointed his gun out at him, and the man said, "One second," and he took out his credentials. He had Secret Service credentials. The man who had fired, this police officer, Joe Marshall Smith, had caught the assassin, but he had Secret Service credentials. And and so at that point, two men came out of the book depository building. They didn't work there. A weapon had been placed there on the sixth floor. It had been planted. Who did it? Two men came out, and they were stopped by police, and they flashed their Secret Service credentials. So they were allowed to go. The Secret Service announced later that day that every Secret Service agent in Dallas was in the motorcade. There was nobody on the ground. So the person behind the fence, the two people coming out of the book depository building after the weapon had been planted there, were all people who were not Secret Service but had been given the credentials by this special group within the CIA. All of that's absolutely documented. What's so amazing is the Secret Service is part of the Treasury Department. Can they print documents themselves? They print all our money. Millions and millions of documents every year are printed by the Secret Service. But for that day, a special secret group involved in assassinations of heads of state printed all the credentials for the Secret Service that day.
Mark, why would they want to take Kennedy out? Was he that bad to them? Was he that dangerous to them? You know, why wouldn't they wait? You know, he was coming up for re-election.
Yeah.
Probably would have won. I think the nation loved him. But why did they have to take him out?
Well, he was doing a few things they didn't like. The only war we had going at that time was Vietnam. It was the CIA's effort. The CIA played a major part in organizing and orchestrating that war, and he was ending it. He said in September of 63 that he was withdrawing 1,000 advisors. We had 18,000 advisors there. He was withdrawing 1,000, and then in November, he again withdrew another 1,000 and said by the end of next year, every American would be out of there. Of course, after he was killed, we ended up with 500,000 troops.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
54,000 were killed. The first American death, basically, attributed to what was taking place of those 54,000 was John Kennedy. He was removed. More than that, though, they were concerned about the fact that Kennedy knew that they had lied to him on numerous occasions, including the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he fired Allen Dulles, who had been the director of the CIA, fired him and decided that he was going to dissolve the Central Intelligence Agency because it had become a policy-making group, an operational group. And as Harry Truman said, it's an interesting article in the New York Times, President Truman had written 1 month to the day, published 1 month to the day after the president was assassinated, December 22nd, 1963, he said, "The CIA is a danger to America. It has become an operational and policy-making group, and it is dangerous." And that's he said, "I set up the CIA, but only for the purpose of looking at intelligence information from all the agencies and bringing a report to me." That was supposed to be their job. He said, "They've gone far beyond that. They've undermined our democracy. They're a danger to America." That's the man who set up the CIA a month to the day after the president was killed in the New York Times. But above all, John Kennedy was going to dissolve the CIA, form a new intelligence organization with his brother Robert, who then was the attorney general, in charge of that. He was going to resign as attorney general and run this new intelligence organization, which was going to gather intelligence and stop the operations. Mm-hmm. How far have they come since that day? The CIA has its own Air Force. When I was young, I was in the Army during World War II. I was only 18 at the end of the war. And we had the Army Air Force, the Navy Air Force. Everybody had an Air Force in the United States. And then later on, it was decided to consolidate them all into the United States Air Force.
That's
and
right.
So we had a single Air Force. Now we have another one. We have the CIA Air Force. And they brag that their drones kill more people in Afghanistan, Pakistan, etc., than does the United States Air Force. They're a rival.
to the United States Air Force. They've become operational completely, and they've become policymaking. It's the fourth branch of government. All the, when you think about the greatest generation ever, the founders of this nation, the most intricate work that they did in putting together a constitution and developing three branches of the government, executive, legislative, judicial, and how they're all related to each other. They have to work cooperatively. They will work in checks and balances. I mean, one section of the House has to declare war. Another one provides the funding. Two separate groups. The president has to administer the war. It was an incredible operation these guys came up with. It was world-shaking, and it still is a message and a lesson for the rest of the world. Now we have the CIA, which has become the fourth branch of government. Nobody in Congress who votes to give them a budget has the faintest idea where that money is going. They're not allowed to know.
That was the voice of Mark Lane, who died this week. His book, one of his latest books, His Last Word, My Indictment of the CIA in the Murder of John F. Kennedy. Martin, one of the most fascinating things about this is we've seen very little coverage. Much of the coverage has been saying, oh, he is a conspiracy theorist.
The whole term conspiracy theory was pioneered by the CIA at this time. Originally, the theories about what had happened to Kennedy were called assassination theories. But the CIA PR people got on that and said, no, we've got to call it conspiracy theory. And of course, if you use the word conspiracy theory, that implies that whatever's being talked about is nonsense. Now, of course, in the real world, bombs go off. People are assassinated and somebody did it, and that is a conspiracy, whoever did it.
We've seen also links between the CIA, Gottlieb's little group, and the Nazis, haven't we?
Yes, indeed. And I think that the intelligence services and are actually above the law, and that shouldn't be the case.
Kevin, you wanted to chip in very briefly there?
I just got on with Martin that the PR effort by the CIA was against... you know, journalists looking in, they're conspiracy theorists.
Okay, yep. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Up Lengths, it's Makawi and Kamal's Arabian Nights. You can find us online and download a podcast of this show at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Please do join us on the Politics Show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
FM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.